Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The debate continues in Congress surrounding one of the nation's busiest airports. D.C. area lawmakers want to nix an attempt to add flights to Reagan National Airport. Hanging in the balance is a reauthorization of the Federal Aviation Administration. To get the latest, we welcome back WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller. Mitchell, thank you so much.
You bet.
So tell us what's going on here. Where do things currently stand? I guess we can start locally, since I'm sure the WTOP has been just banging on your door for updates constantly on what's going on there with Reagan National Airport.
Right. And this really is one of the most contentious issues within the more than $100 billion legislation. And that, of course, is this proposal to add 10 additional flights, 5 flights in, 5 flights out, into Reagan National Airport. And there has now been a formal amendment offered by the Virginia and Maryland senators who want to get this taken out. They are really upset over the fact that it was included by the Commerce Committee in connection with this overall bill. And they have made the argument for several weeks now that it is really going to be unsafe, that is going to add to more delays for people that go to Reagan National Airport. Virginia Senator Tim Kaine actually went on the Senate floor last week to reiterate his arguments. And he again pointed to the fact that it was just last month that there were 2 passenger planes that were taxiing down the runway at Reagan National on not a particularly super busy moment for the airport. And yet they came within 300 feet of each other. And as he said, this is a flashing red light to lawmakers and policymakers that this needs to be stopped. Now, on the other side, there are lawmakers from the West and other parts of the country who say that this is not that big a deal to add that many flights. And they have been pushing for this for a long time. Also, Delta Airlines is among the airlines that would like to add these slots. Interestingly, United Airlines is actually fighting them. This is part of a intra-airline battle, if you will, because United does not want Delta to get more of an advantage at Reagan National. The other thing that relates to the area airports is that Tim Kaine and others argue that the other airports, Dulles and BWI Marshall, could actually take on more flights because they have more space, whereas literally Reagan National is landlocked. So we're going to have to see what happens, but this is going to be a very, very big battle as we move forward on this FAA reauthorization bill.
Yeah, this has been one of the stranger debates that we've seen go around, especially for the DC area lawmakers who are pretty tight-knit community. Do they actually have any shot of getting this eliminated from the FAA reauthorization bill, or is this just going to be, you know, they're speaking their constituents' minds, but, you know, it's not really going to do much?
It does look like there is going to be some movement on this. They have support, interestingly enough, from West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. Sometimes you don't know which side of certain issues he's going to come on, but he is against it. They've also picked up some support from some other senators. And so I think that you are going to see them dig in really, really hard on this. What's interesting about the overall bill is whether or not this is actually going to get completed in time this week. The deadline is at the end of this week. And when they broke last week, it just didn't look like senators were going to be able to make this deadline to actually reauthorize it. There is a very good possibility that they will have to do another short-term extension that was hinted at by the number 2 Senate Republican, John Thune, who just said, with all these amendments and this one that we've just been talking about, that's only one. There are several other amendments that a lot of other lawmakers want to get on, including those that are not necessarily really directly related to the FAA. This has become one of those legislative vehicles for a lot of other bills. So we'll have to see what happens over the next few days.
We're talking with Mitchell Miller, WTOP's Capitol Hill correspondent. Yeah, let's get into some of those other amendments that are attached to this FAA reauthorization, one in which it plans to add more air traffic controllers, which I guess you can never have enough of. But are there any other ones that they're discussing at this point?
Right. Well, there are a lot of provisions in here for airline safety, and they do have pretty widespread support. Among them, as you mentioned, adding air traffic controllers. There's also new technology that the FAA wants to implement that would prevent the type of collisions that were that was cited by Senator Kaine, the concern about these planes on runways taxiing and then getting very close to each other. So they have cited that. Also, for just consumers, people planning to fly this summer, the legislation would prohibit airlines from charging extra for families to sit together, and it would raise fines for airlines that violate various consumer laws. So there's still a lot to discuss, and this certainly has a direct impact on a lot of people. It's not just one of those policy issues that's up in the sky, if you will.
Yeah, it'll especially end those videos of folks trying to shame those who don't move for children when trying to get families to sit right. together. So let's talk other agency news. It looks as if Congress is trying to get an update on just how many workers are going back into the office. They had a goal that they set for them. How are agencies doing in getting all those employees working back in the offices?
Well, of course, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the agencies themselves, including OMB, they say that there is significant progress being made. On the other side, House Republicans in particular are really pushing back on whether or not enough is being done. There was a somewhat contentious hearing last week with the House Oversight Committee, James Comer leading that hearing. And one of those who testified was OMB Deputy Director for Management, Jason Miller. Now, he said essentially that OMB and these agencies are moving forward as they are expected to do to get 50% of their employees working in their office. He also pointed out that many employees simply do not have any access to telework because of the nature of their jobs. He said, so if you add all of those in on a given day, there could be 80% of federal workers actually at the physical workplace where they're supposed to be. Now, on the other hand, Republicans say they are not getting the data and the drilled down information that they really have been pushing for months, trying to get the exact figures from all of these agencies. And then, as you well know, Federal News Network did an extensive survey of federal workers, and it does appear that most workers, about nearly two-thirds, have some type of hybrid setup, with about 30% saying they are fully remote, and a very small percentage actually said that they were working entirely in the office. And that is one of the things that upsets a lot of Republican lawmakers.
Yeah. And so are they going to be pushing any other initiatives to kind of force agencies' hands, or do you see this just, you know, the status quo is going to just keep on going until they can get a better update?
I think it's going to come through oversight. I think not only in the House, but you have Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, as you know, has been very active on this issue. And I think that the Republicans are just going to keep pushing to get these agencies to come up with specific figures that actually show that they do have 50% of their employees working in the office. On the other hand, you're going to have the federal unions who have pushed back a lot. And, you know, I think it's going to be a bit of a tug of war as it's been over the last few years. You know, a lot of federal workers, as you know, have said that what is the point of going into the office if I have to fight traffic for an extended amount of time? I get in, I'm stressed out, and then it turns out that I, as a federal worker, am just basically working virtually on another call that I could have done from my home. So I think you're just going to see this push back and forth between federal workers, the unions, and a lot of lawmakers here on Capitol Hill.
And you can see that in other areas in the private sector as well. And one agency that is dealing currently and trying to figure out its remote policy is the IRS, who has extended its remote work pilot and is also planning to make its workforce a little bigger. What are their plans and how do we see that playing out?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of activity within the IRS, and there has been some positive feelings about that on Capitol Hill, that things are really moving forward now after a long time where the IRS was backlogged with all kinds of tax documents, the IT issue, as you know. But what the IRS is now planning to do is it's going to extend its remote work pilot through early next year, basically toward the end of January of next year. It was scheduled to end actually just before the summer kicked off this year. So they want to basically look at what kind of things are happening within that program. One of the things that they are finding initially is that they are getting more interest in the agency with remote work, pointing out that a lot of the work can be done remotely with the IRS. And then the other issue, as you point out, is the hiring that is taking place at IRS, and it continues to move forward. And that is due largely to that $60 billion that was approved through the legislation that allowed for a lot of the hiring that the IRS has been doing over the last year. There is still some contentiousness back and forth with lawmakers because there were some cuts in that, as you know, but they have put in a lot of money toward their IT situation. They have really picked up the pace on getting all of that backlog basically wiped out. And then in terms of hiring right now through the Inflation Reduction Act, that was the original legislation I was referring to earlier, they actually grew to about 90,000 full-time employees, and that's up more than 10,000 than it was just a couple of years ago. And the IRS commissioner indicated to Congress that they are now looking to actually have more than 100,000 total employees within the next 5 years. So they are really beefing up at the IRS. And what they point out is that when they have more money, when they have more staffing, when they're more efficient, that they can actually bring in more money. Now, on the other side, Republicans say they are targeting a lot of Americans. It's particularly wealthy Americans to bring in that money. And there are actually going to be a lot more audits that are done both at the corporate level, but also at the higher end of the income level. But nonetheless, the IRS moving forward and doing what a lot of policymakers wanted them to do over the last few years.
All right. We'll just have to see how that turns out. WTOP Capitol Hill correspondent Mitchell Miller, thank you as always, my friend.
You bet.
And we'll post this interview at our website at federalnewsnetwork.com. And you can subscribe to The Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.